Today is Wednesday. It's January 25th, 2023. It's 2:42 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are often heard on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio, AM 720 on your dial from 10 to 2 weekdays.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, and you can listen to my podcast, America's Talking.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, host of On the Block on WCIU with Block Club Chicago, and host of the Making Podcast on WBEZ.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter, and you can just write me ericzorn@gmail.com, and I'll sign you up, and I'll tell you if you get tomorrow's edition that you can vote for Brandon's beard as the best beard in Chicago.
But you need
to subscribe to find out how you can do that.
This is just a grassroots movement. Okay?
If you're just listening to this podcast and haven't watched the video pre-roll, which we record and also post, you should go watch the video. You'll see Brandon's beard in action. It's a work of nature. It's well coiffed.
A work of nature. That is damning with faint praise, there, John.
Versus
correct.
Well, it's a work of art. Art. Let's try that again.
Okay. Well, it's.
I'll accept it.
I didn't mean it as an insult. I didn't mean it as a compliment. I just thought I was describing the dang thing. So
you did.
The sheriff of DuPage County is still the sheriff. He doesn't want to enforce, though, some parts of the Illinois new assault weapons ban. He's a Republican, and the chair of that county board is a Democrat, and she thinks that he should enforce every letter of this new law in Illinois. Guys, I wish that they were both in the same political party, because then the focus would be where it should be, not on how Democrats and Republicans feel about guns. We know about that. But does law enforcement get to cherry pick the laws it wants to enforce? Hundreds of people showed up at the latest county board meeting there with signs of support for the sheriff, which to me translates to signs of support for lawlessness. This week, there was a meeting with members of Congress, state lawmakers, and county lawmakers, all saying that he needs to take that comment back, that he will not enforce components of that law. Is this just typical gamesmanship by two politicians, or is this something different?
It's different when people who are charged with enforcing the law are making public commentary about the nature of that law and whether or not they're going to follow it. And I think that rightly causes controversy, because a figure like a sheriff, someone expects not to be a politician, even though that's how our system is set up in Illinois. They expect them to be more like a doctor or a police officer, or someone following orders is kind of what people think of. So when politics comes into the fray, I think it can get very difficult very quickly. So I think there are two things here. One is that there are comments that the sheriff has made about the efficacy of this law.
Mm-hmm.
So saying, you know, criminals are still going to get their hands on guns, whether this is on the books or not. This isn't going to work. That's one set of comments. But when you pair that with comments like when you say you're not going to enforce it, making those two comments at the same time makes it political. Whereas if you had said something like, as a sheriff, it is not clear from this legislation who is responsible for enforcing these new laws, and until I get further guidance on that, my department is going to do this, that sort of de-escalates the conversation. And then I think people can have a rational debate about the interpretation of the law or making tweaks to it.
And that's a fair observation. I think that is true.
And he has made comments like that before, saying it's not clear who is supposed to enforce this.
Or how.
I think exactly. And I think comments need to be more at that level, at the technical level, rather than perhaps even the efficacy of the law. Now, it's okay if a reporter asks, do you think this is going to be effective or not? I understand people have to respond to that. But it's when you mix all of those things together, your opinion about whether it's going to work or not with the actual text of the law, then it becomes a political debate.
And the stance he's taking, Austin, is not that it will be ineffective, although he's saying that, and maybe that's true. He's casting it as a political fight before he even talks about the efficacy of the law. His principal problem with this isn't whether or not this law is a good law, but that they don't have the right to tell him what to do. That if he thinks it's an unconstitutional law, he's not going to enforce it. Like, he's the judge. That's
right. And I don't want to say, I should say, I don't have a quote in front of me from Sheriff Mendrick saying this law isn't going to work. I'm more talking about the discourse and the people at that meeting who were talking about that. So I don't want to say he said that when he didn't. But I think when those things come together, it's very difficult to have a conversation and move forward.
Yeah, it is difficult because we have a system where you have someone who runs for sheriff in Illinois who is by nature political, has to make political statements, has to sort of stake out positions, and then they are asked to deal with the electorate versus, say, a county board chairman who might appoint them or someone. I'm not sure how it's done in other states, actually. I don't really remember how this is done. Like in Michigan, where I grew up, I don't remember if we elected the county sheriff or not. But when you have a situation where you have a person who's making these political statements and they're charged, I mean, what would stop him from saying, you know, I don't believe that the speed limit, I think the speed limit's too low, that this is a crazy environmentalist. I'm not going to enforce a speed limit on back roads in DuPage County. I mean, that would be unthinkable, unconscionable. Or you can even imagine even more broad sorts of things. Like, I think that the prohibition on child pornography is unconstitutional, someone might say. And so I'm not going to enforce that. Well, you just can't have law enforcement officials acting as though they are in an executive or legislative branch like that, that's not where they belong. And we're sort of seeing a flaw in the system right there.
Yeah, this sheriff is really interesting. I mean, he's feeding into paranoia and this idea that people are going to be knocking on your door and taking your guns away. And he was corrected on that after stating that and still has not retracted anything that he said here. I was going to go where Eric did about, you know, you're not going to choose to not enforce the speed limit. You're not going to put a statement out like that. You're not going to choose to not enforce basic laws on the books. That's not your power. That's not what you were brought there to do. And for the many people that voiced their concern at this DuPage County board meeting, many of them expressed, hey, we put you here. We expect you to uphold our laws and protect us. That's your job. Like, that's the whole point. And, you know, whether you agree with the law or not, right? If you can save just one life, it's got to be worth it. Are your assault weapons, is your AR-15 that important? Are you really taking an AR-15 out to shoot deer, high capacity? Like, it doesn't really seem applicable. So it's fascinating to see this opposition. He's one of 80 different sheriffs around the state who have expressed opposition, but he's the one that's saying he's not going to enforce it. In the end of the day, I say lock him up. If he's not going to enforce it, take him out in cuffs.
You know,
I mean, it comes down to that.
I'm imagining a Scott Stantis editorial cartoon, and it would have shown the gallery of people that are in opposition to this, and it would be a bunch of concerned citizens and then some deer. Dude, this is not a fair fight, okay? Cut it out already. But you know where I thought you were going to go when you said there was a lot of people there who were also advocating for him, like an elected official, yeah, you're our guy, fight for guns, fight for our rights. I mean, at least a Darren Bailey could stake out that ground. But I would imagine that a sheriff should be somewhat agnostic about all of that, you know, neutral. He shouldn't be taking that kind of a position.
Right. And if he does take a stand like that, there are ways for a law enforcement agency to downplay, mitigate, look the other way on certain kinds of offenses. And I certainly saw some people making the analogy to how Chicago is a sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants.
Fair.
And
isn't it?
And how Kim Fox has decided that she's going to raise the threshold for shoplifting. We make these decisions in spite of what the state law might be, and that there hasn't been this outcry about that. It does seem to me that it would have been pretty easy for the sheriff of DuPage County and all the other sheriffs around the state to just sort of say, well, you know what? We look the other way when someone's going 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. If somebody is like running an illegal gun dealership, yeah, we'll enforce it, but we're not going to aggressively enforce this law. And just sort of say that to your officers and let it go. But there's a certain amount, a lot of signaling here, of political signaling that's going on. And, you know, they may end up being right. The sheriffs may end up being right. The courts may throw this out as unconstitutional. I don't think they will, but they might. So I would think that that they would downplay it if they wanted to maintain their pose of being an objective law enforcement official, but clearly many of them don't.
A lot of people brought up that analogy that you did, Eric, about us being a sanctuary city and the city's unwillingness to cooperate with federal officials when they're looking for illegal immigrants in this country. I wonder if the difference is, though, that wasn't Tom Dart, the county sheriff, saying that, or David Brown, the chief of police, saying that. It was a legislative body, or it was the executive branch. It was the mayor saying that. The law enforcement officials in Chicago, as I recall now, right? Is this correct? Weren't going rogue. Maybe the city was.
Yeah, I think that's fair, except that the sheriff is an elected member of the executive branch, and so might lay claim to being able to make some sort of unilateral decisions like that. I don't know what the authority is, but again, I do think that this is something that they could have done without announcing it. They could have just said, you know what, this is, we're not gonna be very aggressive about this, and we're gonna wait to see what the courts say.
Yeah,
and we wouldn't have had these big meetings. It would have been on the front page of the Tribune and in all the newscasts last night. So I think there's a certain amount of just performance going on here.
I don't know if you guys heard, but I commissioned a poll that said that I'm now the leading candidate for mayor, with 47%. I'm followed by Willie Wilson and the Easter Bunny. Everybody's got a poll right now. Eric wrote about this in the Picayune Sentinel, as I recall, or at least talked about it on my show the other day.
Oh, I did. I wrote about it in in Tuesday's edition, yeah.
Just give us the overview. What's going on here?
Well, the overview is that a Republican pollster, Matt Podgorski, ran a poll for some organization called Americans for a Safer and Better Tomorrow. I'm not sure what that is, but and he found that Paul Vallis is in first place. Mayor Lightfoot took a poll for herself. She found she was in first place. Marianne Ahern tweeted out a poll of unknown provenance that was had Vallis in first place by at 32% over Lightfoot with 18 and Garcia with 24. And then Alderman Sophia King released a poll showing her in fourth place, a strong fourth place, with Garcia in first place. And things like all these polls, they all come from unofficial sources, let's say. They all come from you know, the campaigns are generating them. And you just know that it's probably Brandon Johnson or Willie Wilson. They've got pollsters in the field, and the polls are probably not showing them what they want to see and what they want the public to know. So we're not seeing those polls. These polls are being, if you accept that these polls are sincerely done, they're way outside. Some of them are way outside the margin of error, because one of them has Lori Lightfoot at 9.8%. The other one has her at 25%. Those can't both be right. So when we do talk about polls like this, we have to make sure we remind people that these polls do not come from objective news organizations or objective polling places. They come from organizations that have been hired. And I don't know how that works, how you hire a pollster and the pollster gives you results that you kind of like. But it's an interesting topic to explore.
I still don't see the value of that, though, Eric. What's the value of a poll that gives you numbers you like?
Well, Shia Kapos reported in Politico this morning that Lightfoot's poll resulted in an upsurge in donations from the business community to her campaign. That when you show strength, that people will start investing in your campaign. It energizes your supporters. I think it probably also energizes your casual voters to give you another look. So it's all good if you hear that you're doing well. I mean, if a poll shows someone at 2%, I say there's some of these candidates, I don't know which ones, let's say Jamal Green's at 2%. Some of his supporters may be thinking, or his donors may be thinking, well, this is not the horse I'm going to ride 4.5 weeks from now. I want to get with a candidate that's going to win, that has a chance, that maybe I'll move my support over to Brandon Johnson, or I'll move my support to Willie Wilson or Chuy Garcia. So those poll results do sink in to the community, and they sink into the electorate and the donors. And so that's why they put them out. And that's why they don't put them out in some cases, too.
The Lightfoot poll itself is pretty interesting. She used the same pollster that Raphael Warnock in Georgia used during his runoff campaign, and the campaign before that that was not a runoff. So that gives a little bit of credibility, for sure. But yeah, like Eric said, they're all saying something different. I've been telling people, like, don't latch on to these polls. They're all hypotheses and thoughts and theories at this point. I think where you really got to pay attention is, where's the TV money being spent? Where are the ads going? And then we got to see where these endorsements go. Because if we remember, when Lightfoot was running for mayor around this same time 4 years ago, she was polling at around 2-3%. She wasn't doing too hot. And then you saw a series of news events like the Ed Burke stuff. She made that tie to Tony Preckwinkle. You saw the Sun-Times endorsement come in, and that momentum started to shift. So really, I don't think any of these candidates are out of it yet. It's just a matter of what the circumstances are going to be. I think these polls are just all thoughts and theories at this point.
Well, no, I was just wondering whether you think, well, you really think that no candidate is out of it yet, or if we're really kind of looking at maybe the top four.
If we're being honest, I do think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, who are the five? Candidates. Who are the five that are in it? It's Lightfoot, it's Garcia.
It's Garcia, Lightfoot, Brandon Johnson, Vallis. Paul Vallis, I think, for sure. And I think Willie Wilson. I really do. Yeah. I think he can't be discounted. He might finish third again, and there's even a chance he might make a runoff.
The two reasons that you do a poll like that is, one, fundraising. You get to go to big donors and say, look, we're surging, we're almost there. You just give us a little bit more. We have a fighting chance in this thing. And then the second is media coverage, just to have your name out there. I think the grouping is important in these kinds of polls. There's not a poll out there that says Brandon Johnson is in first place. There's not one out there that says Willie Wilson is in first place. Generally, you're looking at a three-person race, I think, of Lightfoot, Chuy Garcia, and Paul Vallis. And I think what's also important to know is that when you look at Lori Lightfoot's fundamentals, every poll for a year has had her disapproval at like 70%. Her approval is like somewhere in the 20s or low 30s. So when you have a poll come out that says, you know, high 20s or low 30s percent of Chicagoans are going to vote for the mayor, I think that's very, I think that's really hard to believe, given what we know about her approval rating. So I think right now, Paul Vallis has so much going for him in this race. Partly it's that labor and the left are split. The more traditional, highly transactional labor and left groups on the left are going for Chuy because they think he can win. Socialist and progressive groups are going for Brandon Johnson because he has been a paid worker of the CTU for a long time, and they support him. So you split the money on the left, and then the remainder goes to Lightfoot, right? And then I think among sort of center and center left folks and center left money, they look at Lightfoot and they say, we are not backing this horse. We have been burned for 4 years. She has not accomplished what she has set out to do and isn't capable of doing this. They look at a Chuy Garcia, and I think they think similarly. This is a city in crisis that needs someone with deep knowledge and operational knowledge and leadership abilities to be able to lead the city. And they don't see Chuy Garcia as being capable on that front. And they're more and more willing to say Paul Vallis could be the guy. And that's how I see the race sort of trending. But I still, to Brandon's point, there's so much that could happen here. We saw this Madigan news last week, Chuy being the unnamed person, congressman referenced in the Madigan indictment. That is very different than the Ed Burke news, I will say. I think news media got really excited, like, hey, here it comes, like Chuy and Madigan. This is a juicy nugget. The way the actual details of what he is said to do in that indictment are not anywhere as bombastic as anything Ed Burke was accused of in the federal indictment before the 2019 mayoral election.
Well, but if you remember, Susana Mendoza, who I thought was a fairly promising mayoral candidate back in 2019 for the 2019 election, got blown out of the water by her connection to Burke. And it wasn't even that, you know, grotesque a connection. She was connected to Burke and Madigan. She's a, you know, Susana Mendoza is a politician, and she has been cozying up to power in order to gain power. I think she probably would have been a pretty good mayor, but she just got clobbered by that. And I can see people just hearing this connection between Garcia and Madigan and thinking, let's move on. Let's turn the page. I was curious though, Austin, about what the reaction was like at your shop to Brandon Johnson's extremely aggressive proposals to fund the city. I mean, he was talking about head taxes and transaction taxes, and I was just imagining the smelling salts being passed around the Illinois Policy Institute and everything that he was saying this past week.
So we are there's going to be very soon available. We did a documentary, full feature-length documentary in 2016 about Mike Madigan, and we have produced and are releasing a feature-length film about the Chicago Teachers Union in the coming weeks. And the key point of that is similar to how people forget that 2012, 2013, 2014, average voters across the state did not understand the influence that Michael Madigan had as a politician. We think of him today as this major boogie man. He was not that way. The plurality of people in Illinois did not know who he was or had no opinion in 2012. Similarly, the CTU, to me, is the most powerful advocacy group on the left in Illinois. They have tremendous influence over public policy. They have given money to a majority of aldermen, close to a majority of state senators and state House representatives. They're a $30 million a year organization, and only 20% of that money goes to representing teachers. They're a massive political machine, and people do not understand the effect that that has on their day-to-day lives. Brandon Johnson's fiscal proposals are the clearest example of the effect that CTU has on the lives of people across the state. He's talking about a quote-unquote suburbs tax. He is talking about a head tax on the city. He is talking about a tax on income over $100,000 at the city level. These are ruinous economic policies for the city of Chicago. We need to be attracting businesses. We need to be encouraging small business growth. And it is there's so many things out of touch about it, but I think one of them is, if you're a two-parent household that's, you know, making over $100,000 a year in the city of Chicago, to call that person rich, that they don't pay their fair share, that they deserve to be punished by the tax code, it shows how out of touch and ideologically driven people, organizations like the CTU are today and have become so radical over the last 10 years.
And he's talking about a 3% tax on income.
Didn't he back off of that?
Dollars?
The Sun-Times took that back and said and he said that was a misrepresentation, and I think they honored that, right? No? Am I misreading that? He's not saying tax 3.5% additional for the rich in Chicago, is he?
They did retract that. I think Tribune retracted their whole headline.
It was a
Sun-Times
splash.
I'm not sure they retracted it.
Yeah. I thought the Sun-Times.
I was teasing Austin. I was sure that none of that went over well in his office. But I'm wondering how well that goes over just among your average Chicago voter. Whether that's something that's just too far left at this point.
That was our news click, which is completely non-scientific but anecdotal, right? And so we said, what do you think about taxing the rich in Chicago to pay for city services? And 6 out of 10 said, I like it, or I don't like it, but let's do it. And then 39% said, no. What are you, crazy? Chicago, Illinois? No, we're running enough businesses off as it is. Don't do that.
As long-term listeners know, I'm not opposed to taxing the rich, even though, I might have to pay some myself extra. But I do feel like some of these things are not that well thought out. Some of these things, like some of these transaction taxes, some of these real estate taxes, some of these business taxes that we're talking about, it's complicated, and you can't just say, well, we need money, so we're going to raise it this way, that you can end up hurting a city. And I'm not deaf to Austin's arguments or to the Illinois Policy Institute's arguments. I mean, I think that there are things to be considered here. And my guess is that someone like Lori Lightfoot would love to run against Brandon Johnson. The word on the street is that she wants to run against Vallis. She thinks she has a better chance against Vallis than Garcia. I'm not sure, for the reasons that Austin articulated earlier, that she will match up well with Vallis, that Vallis may be someone who is, you know, shows himself as someone who's got the green eye shade on and who's really a policy guy and someone who has run a lot of things. He's got a mixed record, of course, but that he is someone who does have administrative chops, and what the city needs is some sound administration, whether you agree with some of his positions or not. That's where he's going. And I don't know that. Yeah. And he also doesn't come off as an angry person. And I feel like Lightfoot, you know, she's trying to lean in a little bit to being this brusque thin-skinned, combative leader. But I don't know that that plays that well. I don't think that it does. When I talk to people informally about it, they think, "Well, what is her problem? She's the mayor of Chicago. She needs to be, more of a cheerleader, a little bit less of a scold."
She is one of the biggest political mysteries to me, because I keep wondering, what is her base? Where is her base of support? Where is she going to find that? But then you talk to people, and I've heard from some people who they like the aggressiveness. They like the attitude. And the CPS email controversy, right? A lot of us in the media were spotlighting how that was some, shady, weird stuff. But there's other people out here I've talked to. They're like, "Oh, wow, she's trying to get kids involved in the political process.
To vote for her." Yeah, to help her win. Not the political process.
Let's get them off the streets. that's what some people are saying about it. So it's just interesting. I'm just curious what her base actually is. I don't really believe these polls saying she's number one, but I also don't believe she's number four either. It's tough.
And that what Eric said about, she said publicly, "I want to face Vallis." And that is another huge advantage for Vallis, because if she's training all of her fire on bringing down Chuy Garcia, also, that doesn't make any sense. She wants to run against Willie Wilson. That's the person you want to run against as Lori Lightfoot, but not Paul Vallis. So she's going to keep bringing down Chuy Garcia's favorables. We saw new ads about connections to Sam Bankman-Fried and Mike Madigan come out from her campaign. She hasn't, to my knowledge, run any significant ad spend trying to bring down Paul Vallis at all. So, it's another another win for him. And I would say just briefly, the head tax specifically, and also credit to Brandon Johnson for actually saying, I have a ton of spending I want to do. I want to spend more than we've ever spent as a city. I'm just going to list a ton of taxes that I'm going to make all of you pay to do that. Credit to him. Most people would just ignore it and not say how they're going to pay for it. The head tax, just so people know, is in a city where we need to be providing people with jobs, it is a tax on businesses for how many jobs they have. I hire one person, I pay an extra tax to the city because I hired one person. It is the exact opposite incentive that you want to grow jobs and grow businesses in this city. And that's why Chicago got rid of it. We had a head tax that started in the 70s to cover budget shortfalls. And it was a really, really bad idea, and Chicago got rid of it, and it should stay dead.
Does the proposal cover every business or just larger businesses? Does the head tax kick in at some number of employees? I didn't follow this proposal that carefully.
I don't know the details of the size of the business, but say even if it's a big business, one, that cost isn't really paid by the business. It is passed on to customers. And two, it's a disincentive to hire because it makes, there's a cost associated with it.
It doesn't really matter
what size.
Yeah, or it could be passed on to, it matters if the business doesn't have to pay it, is what I'm saying. Is if I'm running a three-person operation, I don't have to pay a head tax on those three people, but someone who hires 300 people has to. But in either case, I think what might happen is that it comes in out of prices or it comes out of the wages of the employees, that the employer is not going to eat that in all likelihood. So, mm-hmm. You're right. There's no free money there.
It's never been easier to leave the city as a business or a person. All of these things make that decision easier for people.
Well, I'm going to vote for Brandon Johnson or Jamal Green because they said they would establish a municipal sidewalk snow clearing program. It's snowing in Chicago today. We're getting as much snow in the next 24 hours as we have since last February. And it's probably not going to be more than 5 inches for most folks, but it does kind of remind me about how badly I think the city handles snow events. And now these two guys at an accessibility hearing, kind of a panel of the candidates, we're saying we're going to help the people that have mobility issues or access to buildings and the city services. And so naturally it would come up, but I like the idea.
I'm not with you on this idea because it seems like it would be extremely expensive to have people out with their city snow blowers clearing off
all these scrapers, residential houses. Those things.
I like the idea of people who have mobility challenges being served by the ward offices and so on. I think that the city can take responsibility to shovel the snow for people who can't do it themselves. And they may already do that. I don't even know. Maybe I'll probably find out in my old age whether they do that. But it is something that I do wonder about.
The proposed program would cost $750,000.
That seems really low to me.
If you can do it for $750,000, I'll pay for it. But I don't think. I'm not so sure that's a realistic number. I'm not so sure. But you know, really, I mean, it's the city's sidewalks. I always feel this. It's not just because I'm 1 year older than I was last year. When you are getting in and out of a car, when you're driving in the ruts in the city, when there's a lot of snow and ice, which we don't have now, when you're walking in some even business districts or neighborhoods, you want to go to a restaurant or store, and it's treacherous in some areas. I just think it's a bad way for us to live for 3 months out of the year. And I don't think it's crazy to ask the city to do a better job of maintaining those things. It'd be perfect if the Boy Scouts would do it and everybody would shovel their walk and their neighbor's walk. That doesn't happen. It doesn't happen.
Right.
So there you are.
So here's my idea, John. I think I like the idea. I like the idea a lot. I think it could be fleshed out to where it's a little bit cheaper, possibly, as a policy. There's already a lot of community groups that volunteer to help shovel snow and help clear sidewalks for the elderly and those who have mobility challenges. So why not, utilize them, activate them, and also maybe create some sort of a program to employ kids, give kids some minimum wage jobs to do this as well. I think there's a way you can utilize it for public good as well and kind of, create that community village atmosphere if you need to. That's how I would do it. I wouldn't just hire random people to do it. I would try to make it a youth program too.
Well, this wasn't my idea, but somebody said Lori Lightfoot, instead of asking kids to canvass for her campaign, should have asked the kids to shovel the sidewalks. And that would have been, hey, Lori Lightfoot's thinking out of the box. I don't know that that gets her elected, but if you want an externship, there's one for you, kids.
Well, there you go. Rough order of approximation, we have twice as many miles of sidewalk in Chicago as we have streets, right? Because there's one on each side.
Well, they're probably right. Yeah.
Already have trouble in heavy snow of getting the side streets cleared.
But that's
I can't.
But that's because you don't have any place to put the cars. Now you can't clear the streets fully because you can't get the cars off the street to do it. But the side, there's nothing on the sidewalks. Just go clear the sidewalks.
Austin has literally written a book on comparing cities. Are there any major cities that clear the snow? I think there are.
There was a lost chapter just specifically on the city snow removal.
The lost chapter.
Yeah, one day it may be recovered. But I do think there's like a coordination problem that I think Brandon's exactly right on, because there are tons of groups that do this kind of work, but they're not coordinated. And it almost reminds me of how city snow plows used to be, right? They were all kind of ward dictated by the individual aldermen. And then finally, the city scooped up all of them and said, no, this is exactly how the plows are going to go. Ed Burke, you don't get your like street plowed first. It's going to be a centralized service. So there could be, I think, some role of like coordination or prioritization that city government could play, because they have people going. They know which are like the problem areas, I would assume. The problem is, I think, in cost for things like this, is volunteering to help city government is made impossible by government unions always. And you're going to run into lots of work rules. You're going to run into prevailing wage. You're going to run into pensions. You're going to run into health care. They make it very difficult for people who are well-meaning to help. So if you can get rid of some of that, maybe that could work. The city can serve as sort of a centralized hub.
And there also might be some liability issues too, right? If you're signed to clear the snow in front of Mrs. McGillicuddy's house and you don't do it, or you manage to clear it off and leave a bare patch of ice and somebody slips and falls, are you going to be liable for that? So I can see there being all kinds of issues with that. But again, I want to know, seriously, are there cities large or small where
there are. There are. Actually, I saw a list of that, and it's some Minnesota towns. One of my listeners who lives in Richfield, Minnesota, said that in Richfield, Minnesota, they do the sidewalks there. Austin, I'm kind of picking up that you're not super pro-union. Am I hearing that kind of correctly here?
I think unions in the private sector especially serve an important role. But government unions are a totally different thing. Yeah. And this has been acknowledged. Franklin Delano Roosevelt has some of the best work on this about how when you have a service that's a monopoly, like education, those government unions have far, far, far too much power. And they determine the politicians on the other side of the bargaining table with them. And that's a huge ethical problem. And the way that it affects our lives is in both the cost of government and then in the quality of those services. Because the people who aren't in that system don't get quality services and they have to pay for that. So I think it's a huge power imbalance.
I just hope that the plow that comes in my neighborhood is Mrs. O'Leary's plow. They have 50 finalist names to get to name plows that will be plowing the interstates around Chicago. Or is it the interstate or is it the city streets?
But city streets.
City streets. The top, I think it is, what is it, six plow names will then be assigned to six of the fleet of plows. Snow Plow, Winfrey.
Austin Plowers. That's a good one.
Yeah, but that my problem with that one was that that's not really Chicago-centric. Like
not Chicago, yeah.
Mrs. O'Leary's Plow.
I like Super Bowl Shovel, Lala Plow Lusa, Jean-Baptiste Point de Shovel, Holy Plow, Chance the Scraper, and I also voted for Better Call Salt. Just because it's so brilliant.
Well, Bob Odenkirk is from a suburb, right?
Okay, well, there you go. His name is
right? Well, then, okay, I'll reconsider that.
And if my alternate would be City of Big Shovelers.
So here's... No, that's the... Yeah, I like that.
Come on. No, that's not fine. I'm just saying it's what I voted for. That's all.
Speaking of the streets of Chicago, the two-day general admission tickets for the NASCAR weekend in July go on sale next Thursday for $269. You will get access to 2 days of racing and a concert fest that will include Miranda Lambert, Chainsmokers, Black Crowes, stuff like that. We were talking about it briefly on the radio today, and my friend Steve Bertrand, who was once a mincing rascal and still does news on WGN Radio, rather chastised me and my listeners for all of the negativity that we continue to heap on an event that is getting bigger and better all the time. He said, you know what? We're a big city. We can do stuff. Where's that can-do attitude? Why all this so we can't do stuff? So I said, I'll take that advisement. Thank you for your thoughts on that. I'm not sure the thing getting bigger, more expansive, necessarily makes it better. I'm already worried about what a shutdown that's going to create for the city in a very prime time at a very prime location. $269 for 2 days of racing and 2 days of concerts. Austin, you in?
Am I in? I don't think I have a choice, right? Aren't we all like implicitly in?
Right.
It's happening.
Yeah.
we're going to be down here. It's going to be happening. So, well, I guess I'm in.
It's funny you put it that way because Bertrand says, so I'm all for it. I'm not going to go. And I said, you're imposing that on us with your goodwill here, but you don't want to get stuck in that, do you?
Right. Yeah, this is like Eric in the change to the 10 p.m. Broadcast time for Chicago Tonight.
He's not going to watch it.
It comes back to the way in which these decisions are made, and they are always made behind closed doors and then announced to everybody as a fait accompli, which is a French term for a done deal in Chicago.
Oh,
so,
thank you.
So I think...
Cultured.
It comes back to the fact that this is at enormous cost to the city. There are many civic groups that perhaps could do something like this at a smaller scale. There's tons of neighborhood fests that are able to do this, but the city taking a large part of the public way, which belongs to all of us, and essentially selling it off to a private interest without any kind of accountability. That's my problem with it. I like to have fun. I like Chicago being fun. I think Chicago is extremely fun. I don't like when the government does massive events with no kind of guardrails on them and sells away the public interest.
Speaking of music, the Senate Judiciary Committee has begun hearings on Live Nation and Ticketmaster on how they market and sell tickets. New regulations could be imposed as a result of this, and some wonder if the company itself shouldn't be broken up. Others wonder if this is the business of the U.S. Senate to begin with. What with our sending tanks to Ukraine and the debt ceiling looming and documents from the last two presidents and vice presidents popping up everywhere, and I'm not sure I understand it perfectly anyway. And a guy who wrote a book about all of this, it's called Ticketmaster's, Dean Budnick. In fact, he's covering the hearings for Variety, told me he's not sure, based on his observation so far, that the senators themselves understand this issue very well. What observations do you guys have? Brandon, do you go to concerts? You probably do, but you don't have to pay for them because you're Brandon.
He just flashes that beard and they let him in.
Exactly. It's the power of the
beard. Do you know who I am?
First of all, that hearing was so cringe. They were all these congressmen, senators quoting Taylor Swift lyrics, looking for a laugh line, an applause line, and just crickets. I hated every moment of it. It was so bad. But this issue itself, I think that there needs to be more competition when it comes to ticket sales. The chaos that ensued with the Taylor Swift drop, the chaos that ensued with the SZA ticket drop, it's all just showing a lack of competition in the market. And I am pro having competition in the market. So whatever you can do, whether that's regulating Ticketmaster, breaking it up a little bit, I'm for it because it needs to be cleared up before the Beyonce tickets drop. When the Beyonce tickets drop, it's one thing to upset Taylor Swift fans. You upset the Beehive, oh, they will storm the Capitol. Okay, you need to make sure you have this taken care of. You do not want to upset that fan base. So people should be able to buy tickets to an event and not have to sit on their computer for 4 hours, you know, playing lottery. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I don't know if it's, you know, necessarily we need all these hearings and stuff, but there's got to be some sort of change. I'm not personally impacted by it. Like you said, I don't usually pay to go to concerts like that on Ticketmaster.
I was going to ask you, John, if the $269 tickets to NASCAR includes a Ticketmaster fee of about another $50.
Oh, yeah.
That service fee.
That was the suggestion I had to this. So I was talking to Dean Budnick about it, and I said, does the Senate have the power? Can the Congress actually impose rule changes about it? And if they could, I would say that if the ticket is going for $5,000, the fee can't be $600. You have to cap the ticket fee, the service charge, at some point.
Right.
Pick a number, $100. That's still a lot of money. It can never be more than that. And he said his read of this sort of thing is that they could. He said this is interstate commerce. They can impose all sorts of regulations, and if they wanted to, they could. I would be for that. I don't like the idea of telling companies how much money they can make, but there's something seems to me fundamentally wrong about a $600 service charge for something I'm doing on my computer for you.
I think Ticketmaster definitely sucks and everybody agrees. It's one of those services that's like we should think of what the other ones are, but it's like everyone universally agrees that Ticketmaster is a bad experience. But the thing about companies like that is that throughout history, if you wait a few years and let competition develop and grow, and customers take action, maybe artists take action, eventually the better service wins out. And at this snapshot in time, it's very hard to see that happening. And so the gut reaction is to say, okay, federal government, go in and say exactly how tickets and events, you know, should be run and what should be the lines there. And the problem with that, that's very attractive, and I understand why people want to do that. The problem there is something called regulatory capture, which is that right now we're all focused on this, but say they pass a bunch of rules in 6 months, the people working day and night 24/7 to make sure that those rules are to the benefit of them and not to customers are going to be exactly these same interests. And the reality is that it's going to end up worse than before. There are alternatives that are blooming now. There's a company called SoFar Sounds that has a pretty big valuation that does a lot of house show kind of stuff, and they sell tickets directly to consumers. That's like an innovative new model. There is, the independent venue, right? Chicago Independent Venue League. So the people of the Hideout and now the Salt Shed, they have their own kind of ticketing and event stuff that's totally separate from Live Nation and Ticketmaster. The future is going to look more like stuff like that. And people will want to have a more intimate experience with both their venue and the venue selling them tickets. I think it's a bad idea for the federal government to go in and start saying things like, well, if you own a venue, you can't sell tickets. That'll make things fair. It's just going to kill a lot of innovation in the space and things that are better in the future that can displace this kind of crappy model that we're stuck with currently.
One of the proposals that came up during the hearings was to make it impossible or very, very difficult to resell tickets, which strikes me as a nice idea to clamp down on scalping, but there are a lot of instances where you'll buy tickets and you can't go, and then maybe your neighbor – I don't know how they would exactly enforce this with ID or something, like it's a plane ticket or something like that. You've got to show your federal ID along with your ticket to get in. But there's a lot of instances where, you know, someone gets sick, you want to give your tickets to somebody else, or you want to sell them to a neighbor. I don't think that's ever going to work. And I have come out before in favor of dynamic pricing, which is like if Taylor Swift knows that – the seats to her concerts are worth $5,000. She should charge $5,000 for them, and not wring her hands about scalpers, because this is a luxury good. You know, getting to see Taylor Swift is a premium experience, and it's going to cost a premium amount of money. And you know, you can't charge like $70 a ticket when it's worth $700 a ticket. And she and her people ought to be reaping the rewards of that, not mm-hmm. Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster mm-hmm. should make a fair fee for its selling its ticket, a processing fee. I understand that, but not a percentage of that $700. And that's the only way that you're going to get back to some sort of sanity. We can't go back. Technology has made it impossible to go back to the days when you lined up and got a sleeping bag and sat in front of the box office to wait to buy tickets to a concert. Those days are gone. Technology has taken those days away from us. And also technology has made it really, really easy to resell tickets online. So you're going to have this secondary market that's huge. So why not just embrace that and say, well, you know, okay, look, Bruce Springsteen tickets, Taylor Swift tickets, Beyonce tickets, they're going to sell for thousands of dollars. And if you can afford it, great. But your average fan doesn't get to go. Just like your average fan doesn't get to live in a mansion. I mean, it's just...
Seats at a Cubs game or something like that, or a Bears game.
Skybox, yeah.
That's just the economics of it. One of the people that testified, he said that in his band will charge $42 for a ticket, and they will net $6 per ticket sold, and the rest is fees and whatnot. And so I agree with you with a lot of what you just said, Eric, but at least then I would still cap the service fees. Maybe that gets this band more than $6, and nobody has to pay more than $100 for the privilege of waiting online and trying to figure out how to buy the tickets.
I was just gonna say, I was thinking about the long-term impact too on like artistry and music artists. We're in a system right now where like artists make all their money off of touring, and not every artist is Taylor Swift or Beyonce or Bruce Springsteen. So there's got to be a system too where these artists are able to reap those rewards. I'm glad Eric kind of spoke to that of these ticket sales, because they're not making money off their music. Spotify is giving you 1 cent per stream, touring is how you make your money nowadays. The concert is how you make your money, and it's tough to do that in this era.
I think ultimately, so far example I mentioned is one example of how artists are kind of getting around the system. There's going to be more of that. There's a band, great band called Wolfpack, Wolfpeck. They just released an album that's huge, and they're exploring doing their tour through the conference center circuit because of all the red tape that's around venues, right? So it's like you go to you pay for a conference, and it's a whole different set of economics and people you have to pay in ways you can directly sell tickets where you totally get rid of that, you totally avoid that system altogether. So mm-hmm. I think like creative people have always, especially in the United States, like think about the history of punk. Like they found regular venues wouldn't have those bands. They would find houses to play. They'd find halls that would have them. Like people will figure it out. And I'm empathetic to touring artists who are like, these people are taking too much of my money. But I also think like, man, the last, I think 30 years ago, artists that were touring, all the sacrifices that they had to make and all the creativity they had to have, that's what's going to actually solve the problem, not the federal government coming in and saying, you can only charge a $5 service fee for
tickets. When the government broke up the Bell Network or the Bell Company into all the baby bells, the government intervened in that case, right, Austin? Is there an analogy between what they did there and what they want to do possibly with the ticket selling business?
I'm just very skeptical that the federal government is going to be able to fairly negotiate and regulate and consider all of the interests that go into ticketing and live music events. And the people who are going to solve that problem are going to be people who are serving consumers and want to provide a better alternative to Ticketmaster. It is not going to be George Santos taking a vote or some regulatory body deciding it.
Yeah, all right.
It's
I don't know. There are plenty of experiences in our life where, thank God, we do have federal regulation. It's the environment. It's the banking system. Do you just trust that the banks and insurance companies are going to look out for our best interest and the market will do what's best for you and me? I don't.
Aren't there some antitrust issues that we need to talk about? And that's a lot of where this conversation was going, right? Which is that Ticketmaster gets its claws into a music community or some venues, and they get exclusive contracts, and they end up really hamstringing the artists and therefore the fans. And there's some ways that kind of regulation might actually increase the kind of competition that Austin thinks is going to be beneficial. That what I'm seeing as I look at this landscape is the opposite is happening of what Austin says is going to happen, which is that Ticketmaster is getting to be a bigger and bigger behemoth. Now, it may be that in a few years, competition will come along and destroy them, but Ticketmaster seems to have its fingers in more arenas, so to speak, than they used to. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's clear that they've consolidated a lot more of the market. I think it's something like 70% of the ticketing live event market is through these two companies, right, John? So yeah, there's no doubt they've gobbled up a huge share of the market. But you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And we see that with technology platforms all the time. Like, it's going to seem so quaint when we talk about Facebook. It already does, 5 years ago, where it's like, you know, we got to break up Facebook. It's a monopoly. Or we got to break up Google search.
That's a good point.
It's gone. It's evolving. People are destroying every day, working to destroy those things because they want to make a ton of money and provide a better service.
I posted an interesting article about that on MySpace. Nobody saw it.
My Friendster account.
one last thing, guys. About these classified documents that we referenced at the beginning of today's pod, I'm more and more coming to the conclusion that as we don't know what these documents contain or how specifically dangerous they are, this is all political theater right now, and the only crime really is lying about them, which it seems to me has only been done by one of the three, Biden, Trump, and Pence. It seems to me like Donald Trump was the least honest about it, was the least forthright about it. Boy, Pence is running for president, right? Because he had his people figure it out, find it, and divulge it right away. Joe Biden's people found it, but waited 2 months to say anything about it, and then only as a trickle. It's really hard to compare to me the sorts of sins of these three. I'll bet you that anybody who's been a president or vice president for the last how many years probably has documents in places, right? To me, the only thing I would care about, to be honest with you, is, you know, are they the nuclear codes? Is it going to reveal the location of a spy? Is there something that's really dangerous, injurious? Otherwise, I'll give them a pass for, in general, just being sloppy or people that have a boatload of responsibilities and locations to be. I don't know much more about the documents than that, but I mean, if you said, give me a starting point, I would do that. And then the only sin then is lying about it. Eric, do you read it that way, generally speaking?
I sort of do. Obviously, the way Trump tried to conceal what he did and the way he failed to cooperate with the government trying to get those documents back is a much bigger sin than what Biden and Pence are accused of. But I think the net effect of all this, of these stories trickling out, especially when news came out about Pence, that it looked like it's one of these things where I think the voting public is going to say, like, you know, everybody does this. It just happens. And they overclassify documents, and this is not going to play into my vote. I heard David Axelrod say that he thinks that this is actually good news for Biden, because if Biden's running for reelection, he wants to run against Trump, and that this actually takes a little bit of the boot off Trump's neck from the law, because it's going to be hard for the Justice Department to prosecute Trump over this, even though they probably have grounds to. But it's going to look to the public like more of a political prosecution, so that. It just makes Trump's offense look less serious, and so this gives a little boost to his potential or his presidential candidacy. That's kind of a political bank shot as far as I'm concerned, but it makes some sense to me that this is actually probably good news for Biden.
Huh. How about you, Austin? What are your thoughts about this whole story generally?
Generally, it's I've tried not to let myself go down the rabbit hole of the specific, you know, what instigated these searches or what could be in the documents. It just strikes me that to our conversation earlier about Sheriff Mendrick, there can't be laws on the books that are like just okay to flout and that everybody thinks is fine. That's like a problem with the law. If our collective view is, yeah, well, maybe the president should just be able to take whatever they want from the White House, that's okay. The law has to reflect that. It shouldn't be this sort of whack-a-mole of like every 4 years we're going to have another raid on a former president's home because they took some documents. That seems to me like there should be a revisiting of the laws around what is considered a classified document and what people are allowed to take with them and not. Because if not, then we need to, when these things happen, there needs to be like serious charges. It can't just be a slap on the wrist. It has to be enforced fairly and equally.
I'm not sure how much they should be telling us about it, but the lack of information is maddening if you're trying to follow this story or score the sins. Donald Trump said at one point some of the things that he kept were just the top secret folders, and he kept them as souvenirs, and there was nothing in there. And then the FBI says, that's an item. And now it sounds like he's got this cache of items when maybe... being Donald Trump wasn't souvenir enough, right? He actually has to have the little folders. What are you going to do with those?
Yeah, I think in the long run, this is going to be a political nothing burger.
I hope so, because frankly, there's more important things to me for us to vote on or think about than that. And on that, we'll wrap it up today. Brandon was so intrigued by what I was saying that he's clicked out and has exited the podcast. We'll say
his beard had places to be.
Well, we did go.
I'm posting pictures of his beard on my OnlyFans later today. If anyone wants to see it, they're $5.
You know, we're always trying to grow the podcast. So if we said, hey, listen to the Mincing Rascals and we'll tell you how to see Brandon's beard, I'm not against that.
It's on my list of things to do.
Tell your friends to listen to the Mincing Rascals. Spread the good word, and thank you for listening. Brandon Pope's out. Austin, thanks for joining us. Eric Zorn, we're produced by Pete Zimmerman. And who's the other producer of this thing? Ben Anderson. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, fellas.
Out.
Good to see you, Austin, in that hat. I can't tell what the... What the hat
this
says.
Is Mountain Film. This is a film festival in Telluride.
Oh, is your documentary going to appear there?
We have CTU is definitely not. It's sort of, it's like a social justice film festival, so I don't think it would get in. But we did. We worked on another documentary.
I'm going to see if I can get through. The only day that you're showing it is that I can see it is the, I think it's the 8th of February.
Is that the one at the, in Blue Island?
Blue Island, yeah.
Yeah. It's a cool theater. It's new. It's called they started it, I think, during COVID, but it's beautiful. Someone just sent me pictures from the inside during the podcast, so it'll be good.
Austin, somebody wants to say hello to you.
This is one of my favorite podcasts, and I'm just so happy to be kind of in the universe with you, really. You're not in the studio with me, but was Zorn here too?
The Marvel Universe.
Steve just had to click out, and Brandon did too, bro. So you just got Austin.
What's up, man? How are you?
It's great. I'm doing great.
I miss you guys. I'm doing well.
Steve, I think you're not allowed to be on the Mincing Rascals podcast. I don't
this
even
is
think,
afterwards.
It's over, isn't it?
No, we're still recording, and I'm going to put this in the tail end of the thing.
They told me it was over.
Well, it's been over for a while.
Austin, are you whining about NASCAR 2, or do you think it's a good idea?
Oh, yeah, here you go, Austin.
I appreciated your note because I am sensitive to seeming like a no-fun person.
Yeah.
Because of how mad I get when the city does deals behind their back. So I feel like I need to approach it in a way where I have an alternative thing that's way more fun that you could do.
Instead of...
So I think next time... Yeah, exactly. So right. I'm going to look up, like, here's things you could do on that day in Chicago that are better than this freaking thing.
Like go to the Dells or something like that.
Well, Austin...
No. In Chicago. Right. In Chicago.
Austin did find himself compelled to say, hey, I'm fun. I'm a fun guy. I like having fun. I thought, anybody that says that has a problem with fun.
Or a reputation of a problem with fun. I mean, I grew up in a town of 3,000 people where big things happened in Chicago. They could do masterful things. And then, you know, the past few years, and I understand the responsible, ethical sort of government spending and all that, but... It's like every time something comes up, It's not going to work. And it's not just the good government stuff of it. It's just like, oh, I'm going to be inconvenienced with traffic, or the park's going to be closed. You know, and the people who complain about the park, they haven't seen the park in 30 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just came by to say hello.
You're going to be in so much trouble when they find out that you had an opinion about something.
The preceding was not part of the Mincing Ransoms podcast. Good to see you, friend.
See you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Austin.
Peace.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.